I'm Gary Knoll, and this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Always a single theme, always something that we believe the mainstream media or alternative media has not dealt with either at all or objectively. Today's topic, the time is now for progressive uprising based upon higher spiritual values. After all, there are more than 105 million people who are independent. That means that those people once were either Democrats or Republicans. They folded in line with the leaders of their parties. Some things they would agree upon, others they wouldn't, but what the heck, they weren't in power. So there are always this assumption that somewhere in America, probably in Washington, D.C., there is a place where wise men and women come together and make decisions based upon what is best for all of us. If only that were the case. To share insights today is Danny Sheehan. He'll be speaking to us from Santa Cruz, California. Danny is one of our nation's most important and influential constitutional and public interest lawyers. During his 45-plus years, he has handled such public interest cases as the Pentagon Papers, and without his input, the New York Times would never publish the Pentagon Papers by Daniel Ellsberg. The Watergate break-in, Iran-Contra, Karen Silkwood murder case, and so many more. He has represented victims of the Three Mile Island nuclear disaster and fought against the American Nazi Party on hate crimes. Recently, Danny was the lead attorney on behalf of the nation, the Native Nations at Standing Rock. He handled the dismissal of a case against Chase Iron Eyes for inciting a riot and felony trespassing. He's the founder of the Christic Institute and the Romero Institute, and the latter being a nonprofit public policy center in Santa Cruz, California. The author of The People's Advocate, The Life and Legal History of America's Most Fearless Public Defense Lawyer. He is a graduate of Harvard Divinity School, plus he has a law degree from Harvard University. And his websites are Daniel P. Sheehan, that's Sheehan.com, and RomeroInstitute.org. Nice to have you with us today, Danny.
Terrific, Gary. It's a pleasure to be here.
Danny, we're going to want more of a classroom on the air on this. Now, I know you wish to address the dire need of for a movement, a positive, nonviolent movement to commence, what you call progressive uprising, because my interest is getting those 105 million plus people who have walked away from the Democrat and Republican systems and their ideologies and their narcissistic leaders, but they haven't organized a cooperative, collective, conscious movement yet. There's enormous power if they do so, but they haven't. My hope is that they'll be inspired, those listening, to begin this process. You want to, I want to, for one reason, to restore some real humanitarian and spiritual values and ethics into our government, in our culture, in our institutions, in our individuals. Unfortunately, a regressive revolution has been underway for decades now. But this revolution is top-down rather than bottom-up. It takes place in back rooms and boardrooms, behind closed doors, and it manifests as repressive policies at the federal and state levels. Efforts are now underway to rewrite the Constitution. Notwithstanding Trump's threats to change birthright, in the 14th Amendment, the Koch brothers are determined to get enough states on board to launch a constitutional convention, which would rewrite the nation's basic democratic principles and effectively turn the country into a kind of collective monarchy ruled by an oligarchical corporate elite. I think it should be clear to anyone by now that the United States is no longer a true democracy. The late Sheldon Wolum, who we had on this program, made this very evident. The democratic remnants that remain are mere pageantry and ritual, props that give us a sense that we are actively participating in the rule of the nation. But this is largely a sham. Princeton and Northwestern universities have shown that policy after policy is passed to only serve the best interests of a few rather than the larger citizenry. So let's begin by having you describe where the nation is at now and speak about the revolution of the elite that is already underway and unfortunately succeeding in its goal and mission. The forum is yours. Take your time.
Thank you, Gary. I think that the particular moment that we find ourselves in right now, the logistical moment, of course, is being confronted by the administration of Donald Trump and his appointment to head up all of the executive department agencies of people who are members of this extraordinary elite. He, for example, appointed to be his Secretary of State originally the CEO of Exxon Mobil. He appointed to be the head of the Environmental Protection Agency, the Attorney General of the oil state of Oklahoma, who had filed lawsuits against the Environmental Protection Agency, trying to foster and promote the interests of the oil corporations. He has appointed the governor of Texas, Rick Perry, who to be the to stop the global climate change movement. This is an extraordinary set of activities. He headed up the Department of Energy and was just aggressively promoting the petroleum and fossil fuels and coal, all in the face of the global movement to try to stop global climate change. So this elite is in the seat of power right now, and they're dominating and controlling everything. They're striking down all of the executive orders that have been passed over the past, actually since the Franklin Roosevelt. They're attempting to undo the entire effort on the part of the New Deal to rein in and control the robber barons. We talked about this in the past. We know that if the American Civil War was not in fact fought primarily to free the black race from slavery. It was basically fought on behalf of the urban elite industrialists and manufacturers trying to get control of the instrumentalities of the federal government. This was the rising into the full ascendancy, the element that was involved in establishing the United States Constitution under the aegis of Alexander Hamilton. Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson faced off basically in the revolution against the British crown to establish a new government here in North America. And Alexander Hamilton wanted to have it be basically a monarchy on behalf of the elite, the white male financial interests and property owners, et cetera. Thomas Jefferson and Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr and James Madison and others were much more egalitarian. They were much more in favor of having regular people participate in the decision-making process of the government, and they were expounding a natural law theory that asserted that fundamental rights resided in the people, that the individuals had these profound fundamental rights over and against the collective. They believed that in participatory democracy and making decisions, and these two elements confronted each other in the crafting of the United States Constitution. And so we see the original Constitution being a balance between these two elements within the North American culture, the colonial culture. And there are certain ways that was implemented in the Constitution. For example, Alexander Hamilton and his elitists had the dominant control over creating the actual three articles of the original Constitution in 1789. And that Constitution set up a mechanism whereby the people ourselves didn't even get to vote for the president. There was, in fact, a college of electoral college that was set up. And in fact, we did not even vote for the United States senators. the state legislatures picked the senator from their particular new state. The legislatures are the ones that made all the decisions, and in order to run for the state legislature, you had to be a white male property owner. And in fact, to vote for the legislators in the states, you had to be a white male property owner. So at the, in the, with the creation of that original document in 1789, the ascendancy of the Hamiltonians and the elitists was dominant. The Jeffersonians and the Madisonians and Aaron Burr and the others were able to get an agreement that they could put in 1791, immediately after the ratification of the body of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights that set forth this entire fundamental theory of natural law, that individual human beings possessed by dint of their role in the universe, this natural law concept that individual human beings, because we had consciousness and reflective consciousness and intelligence and the ability to exercise free will, that we were endowed by our Creator, as they said, with these inalienable rights, and that they were asserted over and against the power of the elite the elite business interests and financial interests. So that balance was struck at the very beginning of our constitutional history. And that struggle went on all the way from 1791, all the way up to 1864, when the American Civil War took place. And that Civil War, well, broadcast around by high schools and colleges and civics classes, being allegedly to free the black race from slavery, was in fact a major confrontation between these two elements. And unfortunately, the people who were in favor of local law and democratic principles, et cetera, did in fact seize upon trying to protect the rights of the slave owners. And that was a terrible, terrible misjudgment that happened. And so it allowed the industrialists and the urban financial interests to portray the war after in history as a war to free the slaves. But the fact of the matter is that since the end of the American Civil War in 1868, there was this period of a short period of 30 years between 1868 and 1898 with the rise of what has become known as the robber barons. That this was the age of imperialism, the robber baron era. This is the era in which, you know, some 30 families ended up seizing control of all of the economic regions of the economy. They ended up dominating the railroads, the shipping lines, the manufacture of iron and steel, all of the oil and petroleum and energy domain. All of these major areas were taken into private possession by the members of these 30-some families. And they all sat as members of a private investment firm called Brown Brothers Harriman in New York City. They had a law firm, Sullivan and Cromwell, that did their bidding. And they ended up establishing the Age of Imperialism, reaching out to send military forces into South America to overthrow the governments down there and take control of their resources, expanded out into the Pacific Ocean. There was this entire era that went on through the robber baron era. And they created, by putting their corporate lawyers onto the federal benches of the courts of our country, they established a doctrine that the corporation was in fact a person, and that this person of the corporation possessed the same fundamental constitutional rights, natural law rights, as a human being. And they fought off any attempt to regulate the corporation by arguing that it was a seizure of the corporation's property without due process, and that it violated their free speech rights to try to regulate their lying in their commercial advertisements, et cetera. So there was a whole era that went on during the robber baron era that came to its high watermark in 1898 with the ascendance to power of the McKinley administration. And this, they seized control of all of the instrumentalities of our American government. And they ended up driving the entire imperial age of them competing with other nation states around the world to take control of the resources of the planet. And that was going on. That led to the clash in Europe of World War One. The United States became directly involved in that. And the elitists basically succeeded in asserting control. But what they did is they ended up driving the entire economic system of the planet into depression in 1929. And it was when Franklin Roosevelt came to power in 1932, he began to try to push back against these major interests. He enlisted the regular people of the country, the Democratic, with a small D, movement in the country to rise up against them. And but what he did, and this is very important for our discussion this morning and this afternoon, and that is that there was a movement that rose up in the United States to oppose the robber barons, to oppose the white male corporate elite in the country. And it was led by the United Methodist Church National Board of Homeland Ministries. And what they did is they originally began in 1874 to try to train all of their Sunday school teachers throughout the country to articulate what the fundamental Judeo-Christian social ethical principles are that were enunciated throughout the history of the Jewish tradition and throughout the early history of the Christian tradition in first century Christian communities that were egalitarian, they were democratic, they were they shared all of their resources and goods together, they farmed and raised food collectively. All of that original ethos that was in the Judeo-Christian community was articulated during a thing called the Chautauqua Movement. That it was named after the center where the United Methodist Church up in northern New York, out by Buffalo, at Lake Chautauqua, would train their Sunday school teachers all summer long from around the country. They would train them, and that they were all talking in their Sunday school classes about how contrary all of the activities of the robber barons were to the basic Judeo-Christian social ethics. And that became a major movement in the country. And the National Board of Homeland Ministry of the United Methodist Church decided to expand their teaching facility up at Chautauqua, New York, to train all of the high school civics teachers throughout the country. And this huge movement was begun, and the training sessions took place up at Lake Chautauqua all summer long, every summer, and they fanned out across the country. And by 1915, they ended up having over 2,000 Chautauqua sessions, these big, huge tent revivals that would go across the country. And they were not trying to recruit people into becoming Christians. They were not trying to recruit people into becoming Methodists. What they were doing is just enunciating the basic principles of the Judeo-Christian social ethics of compassion, of charity, of love, of support for the values of the community, for trying to stop these elite people from commandeering all the resources of the country and of the world. And that whole movement that went on was set forth a whole set of reforms in North America. They initiated the women's suffrage movement that came to fruition in 1919 with the enactment of the 19th Amendment, having women be allowed to vote finally. They ended up establishing the American labor unions. They ended up establishing the anti-child labor laws. They ended up establishing the initial environmental movement. And they ended up establishing the major post-Civil War civil rights movement. All of that was generated by the initial Chautauqua movement that went on from basically 1875 all the way up to 1930. And when the major depression came on in 1929, the end of 1929, that entire energy that went into saying, see, we told you so, see what the elite will do. They'll drive the entire country and the whole world into depression if you allow them to run unregulated. And so Franklin Roosevelt was elected in 1932, and he began to try to implement the basic principles of the Chautauqua movement, this basic movement that was engined once again by the natural law principles that had been set forth by the Jeffersonians and James Madison and Aaron Burr and the others in that original formation of the Constitution. And it turns out that all of those major founders that were on the side of Jefferson, most of them had been trained at a particular university called the College of New Jersey, which later became Princeton University that you mentioned at the top of the show. That Princeton University, there was a professor by the name of John Witherspoon, and Reverend John Witherspoon taught a course on moral theology. And that's the issue that we want to talk about here this afternoon, is the concept of moral theology. What does that mean? What is the relationship between a mode of ethical reasoning or ethics and theology, which has to do with a whole series of issues having to do with the creation of the universe, the nature of the universe, the role of our human family in the evolution of the universe? These are the issues that are fundamental and profound issues having to do with the role of our human species in tendering to and relating to the natural environment that we're born into. And that's the issue that came to the fore during the Chautauqua movement. And that became the basis for the reforms that were attempted to be put into place by Franklin Roosevelt with the New Deal. And there ended up becoming a clash, because the newly elected Democratic House of Representatives and the newly elected United States Senate in 1932 began to pass laws that were attempting to restrict and restrain and regulate these major corporations that had been created. This new business vehicle had been created by the elite during the Robber Baron era, when they put their business lawyers and bankers lawyers and corporate lawyers into the judgeships. They ended up establishing this principle of allowing the corporation, a shareholder-owned corporation, to completely immunize the owners of the resources, the stockholders, completely immunizing them from any legal liability for anything that corporation did. The managers of the corporation were immunized personally. The board of directors were immunized legally. The only entity that became legally liable for anything that the corporation did, polluting streams, you know, having working conditions where hundreds of people were maimed or injured in their factories with no relief, the firing of people who tried to organize any kind of a collective power on the part of the workers, all of these things, the Roosevelt administration attempted to pass rules and regulations prohibiting that type of activity. And the lawyers for the corporations argued that this was violating the fundamental rights of the rights of the corporation. And they argued that they, as I said, possessed the same natural law rights that an individual did. And they argued that this was a taking of their corporate property without due process, that it was a restriction of their free speech by all the kind of reckless and false advertising that they were doing. And so there was a major confrontation that took place where Roosevelt organized and said, look, the Supreme Court that is stacked now with corporate lawyers is in fact arguing falsely that these corporations are a person and that they possess these fundamental natural law rights. And he rose up and said that if they don't stop making those kind of rulings, he was going to get legislation passed by the House and the Senate to increase the number of judges on the United States Supreme Court from 9 to 12, and that they were going to appoint and ratify 3 new judges that were on the side of the natural law proponents and the argument that this did not attach to corporations. So that was the that period of the alleged court packing movement, which caused the United States Supreme Court to back off and to drop this doctrine that corporations were persons. And that was successful. And so the Franklin Roosevelt New Deal was allowed to put in all these federal regulatory agencies to to restrict and constrain industrial capitalism. But it saved capitalism from being basically overrun by a Christian socialist movement in the world and in North America that was run by the Chautauqua movement. And so that Roosevelt, at one and the same time, reined in the excesses of these corporations, but at the same time saved the capitalist system as the major economic engine, in corporate capitalism. And so that operation remained constrained from at the end of the World War I and the ascendancy to power of Franklin Roosevelt and the Justice Democrats. That remained constrained throughout the entire period during which the socialist movement in the world was taken up by the Soviet Union. It rose to power with the Bolshevik Revolution in October of 1917. They generated the throwing out of the Tsar. They challenged the royalist system all through Europe, in Russia. They insisted upon a communitarian assertion of control of the regular people over the decision-making process. The fundamental flaw in the entire revolution of the Soviets in the Bolshevik Revolution was that they became completely self-consciously atheistic. They, in fact, viewed the Catholic Church, with some justification, as being a tool of the ruling class ever since the Roman Empire. They pointed out all of the corruption in the Catholic Church, all of the mythology that was rampant inside Christianity. And what they did is they condemned it as the opiate of the masses, and they undertook aggressive action to suppress the religious communities all throughout the Soviet Union and in other places in the world where they were attempting to spread socialism. But inside the United States, what happened is that the Democratic Party became the instrument for attempting to feather into the system under Roosevelt and later Democratic presidents like Truman and even Kennedy. They began to feather into the system that was fundamentally a corporate capitalist system that regulated and made all the decisions that trickled down to the rest of the people. The Democratic Party began to feather in restrictions and constraints and regulations. And that went on all the way up until, because they thought they had to do that to prevent world socialism from confronting the capitalists and establishing some kind of a socialist revolution, even though that socialist revolution was atheistic. And so what happened is that the atheistic socialist movement around the world ended up pushing out and taking all the oxygen away from this previous Chautauqua movement that was basically a Judeo-Christian social, ethical, spiritual uprising on the part of the people in North America against the robber barons. And so that whole Chautauqua movement sort of atrophied in the face of the worldwide socialist movement that was, in fact, consciously atheistic. And that operates, that confrontation between the white male corporate elite in North America, running the corporations and running the capitalist system, and attempting to get away with as much as it possibly could by means of imperialism and fighting off government regulations, et cetera, that they remained in the ascendancy inside North America and throughout Europe. And that went on in a fundamental dialectical confrontation between a Soviet-led worldwide atheistic socialist revolution in opposition to another bad guy, which was the robber baron, the corporate capitalist elite. And that dialectic is what we were all raised under. All of us in the baby boom generation, you know, born at the end of the World War II, and all of us lived in that all the way up until the dissolution of the Soviet Union on December 31st of 1991. With the dissolution of the Soviet Union signed by President Gorbachev, and dissolved that whole thing because he realized that that dialectic had come to such a point where both sides were armed with thermonuclear weapons and it was threatening the destruction of the entire human species. So he chose to back off from that dialectic, recognizing the dangers to the human family, gaining promises from the, from James Baker and George H.W. Bush, getting agreements from them that they would not try to push NATO into Europe and that they would agree to a stand down from the Cold War. That was what the whole agreement was. But the problem was, is that as soon as the Soviet Union voluntarily dissolved, what happened is George H.W. Bush, who was the president of the United States at that time, his Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney, and his entire staff, Paul Wolfowitz, David Addington, Doug Feith, Scooter Libby, and that whole crowd, came together and they decided that they were going to take extreme advantage of this decision on the part of the Soviet Union to step back from this fundamental dialectic. And they decided, Wolfowitz and the rest of the people in the Defense Department under Dick Cheney during the Bush 1 administration, they decided what they were going to do is step forward into this vacuum, and they were going to try to establish full spectrum dominance over the entire planet. And so they dropped all pretenses of being anything other than raw robber barons and tried to reinstitute the robber baron era, the same era that had followed the end of the American Civil War. They decided this was going to follow the end of the Cold War, and they were going to reassert the power and the dynamism of the robber baron movement. And that is what we have seen happen. And it rose into power, and it rose into power under George Bush Sr. It was followed up by George W. Bush, George Bush Jr., and now it's been being put forward in spades by Donald Trump. So what we're, the moment that we find ourselves in, logistically, is the reassertion of the dominant power of the robber barons using the instrumentality of the shareholder-owned private for-profit corporation, once again being endowed with the alleged rights, privileges, and immunities of natural law human beings. And this is in that decision that was made by the United States Supreme Court that everyone knows about, the Citizens United, that said, oh, on second thought, we're going to go back to the theory that led to the major world depression. And we're going to once again assert through the Supreme Court that corporations are people and that they have these same fundamental natural law rights. And therefore, any attempt to regulate them or crank them back is going to be viewed as a violation of their fundamental rights. This is a profound misunderstanding of what the entire origins of natural law rights are, that attach to individual human beings, that generate our right of free speech, free assembly, freedom of the press, freedom of association, the right to vote and participate in a democratic decision-making process. All of those fundamental rights that attach to individual human beings do not attach to a completely artificially created state-licensed, state-created corporation for this business elite. So that's what we see happening right now. And so that my argument is that what we need to do is we need to overcome the fundamental flaw in the socialist revolution that was generated by the Bolsheviks and the Soviet Union and world socialism that was self-consciously atheistic. And we need to go back to the fundamental understanding of the Chautauqua movement that was rooted in basic Judeo-Christian natural law principles, similar to those that were taught by Reverend Witherspoon to the founders of our Constitution. Now, there's a very strong and pointed and clear constitutional argument to be made on this behalf, because that is the fundamental underlying thesis of the entire Bill of Rights of our Constitution. That theory of natural law has been basically endorsed by the American Constitution. It does not require that one be a theist. It does not require that one believe in some god that's sitting, a white male, you know, bearded person sitting on a throne in the sky. These are all images and metaphors that were developed by the Catholic Church back in the Dark Ages, basically when, you know, 99% of the people in the world were illiterate, and that they didn't even go anywhere more than 50 miles away from the place they were born in their entire life. And so those medieval primitive images and metaphors that were designed to try to share the substance of natural law principles have become totally outdated, and that the institution of the Catholic Church and the additional Christian churches have latched onto those medieval images and metaphors, and are, as a matter of institutional inertia, are not letting go of them. And so what we're actually encountering right now, and this is extraordinarily important, is that there has been a major revolution that has been begun inside the Catholic Church, led by the Jesuit order, led by the Society of Jesus inside the Catholic Church. That they were formed in 1547 with a specific mission of reforming the Catholic Church, of getting rid of all of this corruption and terrible things that were going on in the Catholic Church that generated the Reformation. And they were actually appointed and created in 1547 to try to allay the need to have a Reformation. But they were, in fact, basically suppressed by the Catholic later popes, and so that they didn't succeed in doing that. But they have, in fact, been reborn, and they rose up under a new head of the Jesuit order, Pedro Arrupe, back in 1962. They rose up under John the 23rd when they had Vatican II, and they rose up and said that the people are in charge of the church. The people are endowed with these fundamental human rights, and they have a right to push off the hierarchy of the church. They have a right to take over the discussion of fundamental human values. They have risen into the ascendancy. The Jesuit order has become the point of the spear of the social justice movement inside the Catholic Church. And what we're confronted with right now is we have, for the first time in the entire history of the Catholic Church, which is the largest single religious denomination in all of Western civilization, we have the first Jesuit as a pope, Pope Francis, and he has stepped forward and he has issued a series of proclamations. And one of them is this thing called Evangelii Gaudium, that is the joy of sharing the good news. And what he is saying is that this is the time for people to speak up once again on behalf of the good news, that there is, in fact, such a thing as truth. There is such a thing as a moral referent on the basis of which one can make a judgment about what's good and bad, and can base legislation and community decision-making to forbid certain types of conduct that are damaging to individuals and to the community. That he is leading a major revolution inside the Catholic Church. He's fired the entire board of directors of the Vatican Bank. He's replaced all kinds of the bishops and stuff around the world, and the cardinals. He has banned now any cardinal over 80 years old from being able to vote in the conclave for the next pope. There's a basic thing going on that people need to understand, that within the Catholic Church, as the largest single religious denomination in Western civilization, it is flowing down into the other Protestant denominations that are all derivative of Catholic Christianity. It's being taken up by the social ministry movements within the Union of American Hebrew Congregations and the progressive elements inside the Jewish community. There's a major rising up inside the religious communities around the world to confront these major global capitalists who have, in fact, supported the rise of fascism in the world. Because fascism is, in fact, one of the tools of the major white male industrialists, that they have created the fascist movement around the world. They created the Third Reich in Germany. They helped the Brown Brothers Harriman that I mentioned, where these 30 family heads used to sit and make policy decisions. They're the ones, through the Union Bank of New York, actually funded the rise of the Third Reich in Germany. So that fascism is, in fact, a handmaiden to the industrial capitalists around the world. And so what our alternative to that is to raise up a natural law grounded spiritual discussion of what the fundamental predicates for moral values are in the universe. And Francis has addressed this not only in his papal exhortation of 2013 called Evangelii Gaudium, but also in his papal encyclical on global climate change, in which he has specifically identified transnational corporate capitalism as the fundamental driving engine of global climate change, and that we need to have a radical transformation in the economic system of Western civilization. And it has to be much more socialized, and it needs to be communitarian, and it has to be infused with not class consciousness, not confrontation between classes, as was argued by the atheistic socialist movement generated out of the Soviet Union, but out of a positive compassion in caring for other human beings, in other life on the planet, and indeed for the planet itself. The entire natural law theory of fundamental human rights that attach only to human beings, not to corporations, but to other living entities, and not just human beings, but other conscious animals, other life forms in the sea. You know, there needs to be an affection and indeed adoration of the value of life in all of these different living forms. And it leads to not only the prohibition of the death penalty that is being espoused by Francis, but in fact, it leads to an affirmative support for the life systems on the planet. And it authorizes the explicit restriction, once again, like Franklin Roosevelt, a restriction of the activities of these transnational corporations, that this is what really needs to be done. So what I'm saying is that the time has arrived now that this robber baron mentality has come to full fruition in the administration of Donald Trump, that what we need to do is we need to, sorry about that. I can't get rid of this thing yet. But anyway, the bottom line is what we need to do is we need to reestablish the Chautauqua movement. We need to reach out to people in all communities of faith, not just religions, but communities of faith who believe that there is such a thing as a natural law, that there is a way for human beings to be able to discern the unitive phenomenon that bonds every single ultimately irreducible integer of matter in the entire physical cosmos into one unified harmonic whole, that there is a faculty that our human species has that is evolving teleologically and progressively into the point where more and more people are able to directly, experientially encounter the unitive phenomenon in the universe. That in this unitive experience actually communicates to people the balance that needs to be established in one's own private life, in their private conduct, and the community's conduct toward each other and toward other living things and toward our planet. That this natural law principle has to be the engine that generates a new uprising, a new Chautauqua movement that shares this good news, that there is, in fact, a process underway in our human family. Are we still here?
Yes, we're here.
Okay, I'm sorry. Just someone's trying to call me. I'm sorry about that. So the bottom line is we need to regenerate this Chautauqua movement, this natural law movement around the planet, to be able to share the good news that there is this process going on in our human family that is raising our consciousness to be able to discern the unitive nature of reality, that in harmony with that balance, we can make decisions as to what particular human conduct, both individual and collective, is either harmonious with or disharmonious to the natural order of being in the universe. This is not theistic. This is what is called a sixth paradigm worldview, a radical monist worldview. It's been espoused by Socrates. It's been espoused by Plato in their secret teachings. It was, in fact, espoused by Jesus in his secret teachings to the disciples. There's a whole discussion of this. There's a book called Reality by Peter Kingsley, and he talks about the pre-Socratics discovering that there was a process of meditation that had been discussed in the Eastern traditions, in the Buddhist traditions, the Taoist traditions, etc., way before the birth of Christ. There was a meditative process that human beings have discovered, that if people engage in this meditative process, they can get their consciousness quieted down from all of the noise and static of everyday living. They can get into a state of consciousness that is able to directly access this unitive phenomenon that bonds all of what they refer to as the atoms in the universe together, and that this gives you a normative experience from which you can actually elucidate principles and policies that are harmonious and supportive of life and supportive of the best interests of the entire community. And at the same time, do not violate the fundamental rights of individuals to free speech, to their own attitudes about religion or with it or without it, you know, the right to free press, the right to free association, these fundamental values that flow from a natural law experience that will allow us to collectively make decisions on behalf of the community while at the same time fully respecting the individual rights and liberties of individual human beings. This is what we're calling for. That I'm actually here in my office in Santa Cruz is on the top floor of the old former Catholic high school here in Santa Cruz at Holy Cross, i.e. Santa Cruz Cathedral, that they've given us the entire top floor of their former high school to establish a social justice center for people all through this area. We've been working we got a law passed in California with Jerry Brown, former Jesuit seminarian, got a law passed that allows individual counties, individual cities, their county board of supervisors to make a decision to establish their own, a community-owned energy company, and that they can purchase clean energy, non-petroleum, non-fossil fuel energy. And we have gotten that law passed in California, and the county boards of supervisors of all three counties, as I stand here looking out my window over Santa Cruz, that Santa Cruz County, Monterey County, San Benito County have all voted to have complete clean energy. We've gotten the law established that as soon as they vote to establish such a community-owned energy company, that all of the customers of Pacific Gas and Electric, the fossil fuel generated energy company, all of their customers automatically transfer to us. And we now have 100% clean energy for all three counties. This has also been established up in San Rafael, up in the counties up there. We're now organizing down in San Diego. We're going to be organizing the entire state of California. Every county in the state of California is going to be passing this resolution and having 100% renewable energy in California. We've now gotten, also Jerry Brown has sponsored a legislation that mandates that all energy in California be supplied by completely renewable, non-global greenhouse generating gases, by 2035. So that's what we're doing here. And we're going to do this up in Washington State, up in Oregon. Then we're going to move this operation also into New York and into Vermont, in Rhode Island, in Massachusetts. And what we're going to do is we're going to organize both coasts of the country to establish completely safe alternative energy in a completely legal way, establishing a complete different economic system for generating energy. We've also gotten statutes passed here in California mandating that all of the cars in California by 2040 are going to have to be electric cars, to have zero emissions of global greenhouse gas. We know as lawyers how to do this. we know how to implement these natural law principles into laws. It's not theological. It doesn't violate the First Amendment by establishing a religion of any kind. But what it's doing is it's a non-theistic natural law theory of social justice. And there are entire books written about this. There's a book that's called Physics, Philosophy, and Theology, which was written by the director of the observatory, the Papal Observatory in Rome, William Steuger, S-T-O-E-G-E-R, William Steuger, and George Coyne, C-O-Y-N-E. These are two Jesuits that ran the Pontifical Observatory in Rome. And they've set forth this whole analysis of understanding where our place is as human beings in the universe, that we are, that the universe has not been created just for us. You know, there are other life forms that exist on other star systems elsewhere. We're now becoming cognizant of that. We've now discovered for the first time, with the putting up of Hubble in the Planck telescope, et cetera, that we've now discovered that there are literally billions of other planets and other star systems that are capable of potentially sustaining life. We now realize that there's a major discussion has to be undertaken now about our place in the universe, that we know from Copernicus and Galileo that we're not the physical center of the universe. We adjusted to that, but we created this pretended pyramid at which we as the human species now reside at the peak of the apex of the pyramid of all life forms in the universe. Okay, that isn't true either. And so we have to have a profound discussion of the fundamental questions that need to be asked by our human family about our place in the universe and our role in the universe and the role of consciousness, human consciousness in the universe, now on the very brink of discovering that there is other life in the universe. That this is another point that we find ourselves in here at this particular time. So that I believe that the regeneration of this social justice discussion through a prism of natural law principles and the rekindling of the Chautauqua movement that can generate, you know, the 2,000 or more of these sessions where people gather together. We have a major contributor up in Canada who makes these gigantic tents for circuses and for weddings and special gatherings. He's agreed to provide tents for us. We just have to get the trucks to move them around and to go into. We're targeting right now 60 different congressional districts around the country where we believe that genuinely progressive people can be raised up to articulate these principles, to hold themselves out for public office, not only for the United States House of Representatives and for the Senate in that state, but also for state legislatures, the Senate houses, assemblies, and for town mayors and city councils. That we are in an emergency situation here, that we are confronted by the potential onrushing catastrophe of global climate change. And these robber barons are still in control of the government. They're still in control of the House of Representatives and the Senate, financing the campaigns. This same Supreme Court, you know, filled with robber baron judges, have now, in fact, insisted that the corporations have a right as a fundamental human right to give whatever contributions they choose to particular individual candidates. So we have the Koch brothers and other major robber barons running around paying literally millions and millions of dollars for the campaigns of people like Cruz in Texas and others like that, that we have to stop this now. We have to rise up in the same way that the people of the Chautauqua movement did back in the face of the robber barons in their first pass at dominating the whole country. And we need to do this now. And we need to have a profound understanding of what the fundamental physiological, biological, and metaphysical sources are of consciousness and why human beings are vested by dint of their very nature itself to have conscience, to make decisions for ourselves, to exercise democratic control over the decisions that are made on behalf of the collective. And we need to do this now. because the emergency is upon us. We all see it happening all around us. Texas being flooded out by massive hurricanes. Florida being wiped out, the panhandle. All of Northern California burning. Every summer, massive typhoons. Destroying entire islands in both oceans now. This is descending upon us rapidly. And if, in fact, people need a strictly utilitarian motive for moving now to remove these people from power and to replace them with people that are rooted in a fundamental natural law understanding of our relationship between human beings and our environment, the time is now. So that's the emergency situation, I think, that we have to mobilize for, establish a new Chautauqua movement rooted in natural law principles, look to the history of the Chautauqua movement, come to understand what this new religion kind of thing looks like, a genuinely spiritually rooted political movement. Ken Wilber has a book called The Religion of Tomorrow. It's been published for a number of years now. People can also read Nuclear Evolution, Christopher Hill's book, Discovering the Internal Energy Systems in Our Human Body, to which we can direct our attention in the process of meditation to actually raise our own individual consciousness.
Danny, we're out of time. Only you could take an entire 54 minutes and keep on pace and give us this incredibly intricate and interesting discussion. You believe that whatever kind of a concerted movement of progressives rising up to launch this spiritual valued energy, this is also the thrust of Andrew Harvey's efforts to train spiritual activists. There's some historical precedents to this and therefore some lessons that we can learn from, although history has also shows that trying to exactly replicate the past usually fails. But the movement you're discussing of the late 19th century and the 1960s civil rights movement are some American examples that were highly effective. The evangelical churches had successful movements, such as the First Great Awakening in the mid-18th centuries, and the Second Great, such as the Awakening during the first half of the 19th century. Both awakenings propelled expansion of the evangelical denominations. We can see their ultimate successes today in the Republican Party, shamed as it is. But this success goes back over 150 years. And of course, Gandhi promoted the idea of spiritual politics. And we can think of people like the Daniel Berrigan and Dorothy Days, who brought together spiritual thinkers and ethical politicians. But postmodern liberals in general are neither religious nor spiritual. And increasingly so. I find true and deeper spirituality primarily marginalized in the United States, where it's been coalesced with trivial pop beliefs such as generating only prosperity. The new atheism is mostly associated with left liberalism and the cult scientific reductionisms. So I believe that you have given us a lot to think about, and we look forward to our next conversation.
Brother, there's far too many of you die. You know we've got to find a way to bring some loving here today. Father, Father, we don't need to escalate.